From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the families of 16 civilians killed by NATO's 1999 bombing of Serbian state television were told that they would not have their day in court. The European Court of Human Rights holds that attacks on broadcast stations are not legal unless those stations are engaged in military operations. But Yugoslavia had not signed on to those human rights conventions and so was not covered under them.
More recently, American forces have bombed Taliban radio facilities, and just over a week ago, the Israeli military took out the Voice of Palestine. Human rights and journalism groups are concerned about the targeting of media outlets. Even under the European law, they say, military chiefs tend to blur the distinction between what may be an ugly but legal arm of propaganda and what is a legitimate military target. Joining us now is Mark Regev, spokesman for the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll just start from the beginning. Why did the Israeli military destroy the Palestinian radio station, the Voice of Palestine?
The strike against the Voice of Palestine was part of a surgical strike against infrastructure targets that have been part of the terrorist network that has been attacking Israel.
Radio and television stations are considered civilian facilities under international humanitarian law. Hasn't Israel violated those laws by destroying the station?
We're talking about the propaganda vehicle for an autocratic regime. And I'm not sure the United States acted very differently in its war against the Taliban or in its war against Milosevic in Serbia. If you have a broadcast which calls on Palestinians to go into Israeli streets and to indiscriminately target innocent civilians, and that is an ongoing effort. If you have the praising of terrorism, and this is in the framework of an ongoing terrorist campaign, just as we go after people who encourage the terrorists, who recruit them, who train them, surely we have a right of self-defense. We're not talking about political propaganda here. This station has specifically, and over an extended period of time, called on Palestinians to become suicide bombers.
Critics of the Israeli action against VOP say that attacks like the one on the facilities place all journalists covering wars at risk by undermining their immunity as civilians. How do you respond to that?
That's completely untrue. The Israeli law and the clear instructions of the Israeli army is to do everything to safeguard the lives of journalists who are trying to cover the conflict. And I would point out that in our surgical strikes, we make a maximum effort to avoid any sort of collateral damage with innocent people being killed. In the attack on the Voice of Palestine radio station, it was a surgical strike. I don't believe there was a single civilian casualty.
Mr. Regev, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Mark Regev is the spokesman for the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., and we're joined now by Joel Simon, the deputy director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Back in January of this year, he wrote an article entitled, Should a Broadcast Station Be a Military Target? And welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
We just spoke to Mr. Regev, who said that the destruction of the Voice of Palestine facility by the Israeli military was justified because it was inciting violence and terrorism and was part of a larger terrorist war against Israel. What's the committee's position on that?
The Geneva Conventions are quite clear, at least in our view, that journalists are civilians and broadcast facilities are civilian objects. That means they cannot be targeted. They could potentially become a military object if they're used for military purposes. But our analysis of Voice of Palestine broadcast, the kinds of things they're putting on the air, don't give any suggestion that the station is serving a military function. And therefore, we believe it's not a legitimate target and that the destruction of the station is not justified.
Well, Mr. Regev also said that the attack on the VOP was no different than NATO's bombing of radio and television in Serbia in 1999.
Well, that was a very controversial decision by the U.S. government, or wasn't the U.S. government, in fact, it was NATO forces to target radio and television Serbia. And that cruise missile that destroyed the station also killed 16 people. We expressed the same concerns at that time. And if you'll recall that at the time that the bombing took place, that NATO justified it by saying that what was being put on the air was propaganda. And they didn't even use the term military purposes. Later on, after the bombing and after some criticism, NATO officials later explained that they targeted the station because it was part of military command and control. But the reasons for that attack have never been clarified. We are continuing to request that they be clarified, because what's at stake here is really important. If a military commander can, on a unilateral basis, make a determination that an enemy broadcaster is propaganda, then they can go ahead and attack it. And what's to prevent an enemy from making that determination about CNN or Fox News and declaring those stations military targets?
During the crisis in Rwanda in the mid-90s, a broadcast station was used to incite horrific acts of violence. Under existing law, could the station have been a target?
I believe it could. I mean, because the British anti-censorship group produced a very detailed report on how the station was actually used to coordinate specific attacks by Hutu militia against Tutsis. So it formed a very specific function in terms of military communication. It may also have been used to relay commands to the militias. Based on that, it would lose its civilian immunity and be subject to attack. It was eventually attacked by Tutsi forces, and that, as far as I understand, was legal.
Isn't it sometimes difficult to distinguish between what is just objectionable propaganda and what is a military tool?
The conventions do not lay out a specific definition of what a military function is. And that's a determination that has to be made by the military forces. So there is some debate. In my view, incitement, hate speech, propaganda, objectionable speech of all kinds do not serve a military function.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joel Simon is the Deputy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
A powerful media image has been a rallying point in the latest wave of violence in Israel. It is of a 12-year-old boy named Mohammed Al-Dura, shot in his father's arms in the Gaza Strip at the beginning of the current intifada in September of last year. This particular death, caught on film by France 2 Television, was reproduced everywhere and even incorporated into a promo for the Middle East news station Al Jazeera. Reporter Deborah Campbell traces the impact of the pictures on the reporter who took them, on the editor who chose to air them, and on the family whose dead son now belongs to the world.
Talal Abu Rahma, a Palestinian correspondent for France 2 and CNN, had taken shelter behind a van when he spotted the father and son huddled opposite the Israeli military post. When he sent the footage to Charles Enderlin, the Jewish bureau chief for France 2 in Jerusalem, Enderlin contacted their Paris headquarters.
It's very strong. We must give a warning to the viewers. These are very disturbing pictures. I called the Israeli army spokesman.
The army spokesman dismissed the incident as an example of Palestinians making cynical use of women and children. But the image of father and son became an instant symbol for Palestinians opposed to Israeli occupation. At a Gaza souvenir shop, the image appears on t-shirts next to another revolutionary icon, Che Guevara. Arab musicians sing popular songs about Mohammed. But within Israeli media, coverage focused mainly on the follow-up investigation. In a 60 Minutes episode, the general commanding the area, General Yom Tov Samia, told Bob Simon he would clear the name of the Israeli soldiers. Since the actual location had been destroyed by the army, to deny Palestinian gunmen cover, the army said, it staged a reenactment that aired on 60 Minutes. CBS quoted reports that said investigators commissioned by General Samia were not actually ballistics experts, and at least one of the investigators publicly stated prior to the investigation that he was convinced Palestinians were responsible. Later, the Israeli Army Chief of Staff told Israel's parliament that General Samia had acted alone and the army was investigating his actions. The investigation also questioned why father and son were in a war zone, but Enderlin explains it took place at a major crossroad in Gaza. For the Al-Dura family, whose home has become a shrine to Muhammad's memory, their loss is first personal, then political. His father, Jamal Al-Dura, is dismayed by the way images of their son's death have been commercialized by other Palestinians.
I had very bad feelings when I saw some toilet paper. They put the picture of the killing of Mohammed with me on the cover just to sell it. I didn't like it because this is a symbol and a martyrdom. The next day, people took the roll cover and threw it in the garbage.
Rumors spread of Jamal al-Dura's instant wealth. But while other funds were collected throughout the Arab world, he says none ever reached him or any Palestinian. His box-like home in the Bariij refugee camp is furnished with white plastic chairs and a child's bed as a sofa. But social workers told him he no longer qualifies for aid because, apparently, King Abdullah of Jordan has given him a palace. Jamal is angered by these accusations.
Of course I will leave my home and live in the palace. I wouldn't live in the house that fills up with water in the winter.
For Abu Rakhma, the journalist who took the famous picture, the incident meant professional recognition. He's received some 15 journalism awards at international festivals. But fame brings with it greater risk. 45 journalists have been injured by bullets in the region in the last 15 months, so he heeded safety warnings and for a time dyed his hair before going to the front lines. More frustrating are accusations that he used his profession to further the Palestinian cause.
I think these people, they don't need me to defend them, you know. I'm a professional journalist. I will never do it. I will never use journalism for anything, because journalism is my religion. Journalism, it's my nationality. Even journalism is my language.
Charles Enderlin, the Jewish bureau chief who decided to air the footage, has had his share of fallout.
I got the Israeli extreme right on my back. There were death threats. My wife and my two young kids were also threatened. We had to put private guards at night around our home. Since then, we moved, and we changed also our phone lines.
Early on, Enderlin decided to waive agency fees and give away the footage.
For a simple ethical point of view, I don't believe that we could have made money with the death of Mohammed Abdullah or any other child. By the way, if it would have been a Jewish child being killed in front of the camera, I believe our reaction would be the same. We tried to show the reality of what happens here. For us, the sad story of Mohammed Abdullah belongs to the sad reality of this region.
Israel recently refused to renew Talal Abu Rahma's press card for undisclosed reasons. France 2 and CNN are planning to go to Israel's High Court to have it reinstated. For On the Media, I'm Deborah Campbell.
Coming up, the argument over public radio's coverage of Israel and the increasing sounds of silence in Zimbabwe.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. Back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. NPR has long been under fire from advocacy groups who allege the network's coverage of the Middle East is biased. The charges have come from advocates for Israel as well as the Palestinians. Many critics who believe NPR is unfair to Israel have stepped up their complaints in the last year, targeting the network and several major market stations with letter-writing campaigns, newspaper ads, and now financial protests, leading to questions of journalistic responsibility and fiscal fallout. Philip Martin reports from Boston.
For 15 years, Hillel Stavis, the owner of Wordsworth Bookstore, a landmark Harvard Square establishment, has taken his entire advertising budget and put it into public radio.
We're not talking about a lot of money. You know, we're not a chain bookstore. We're a small independent bookstore. And it certainly was under $15,000 a year. But for us, it was significant.
Potentially significant for others, too. Principally WBUR-FM, a respected award-winning NPR member station that serves the Boston area. Altogether, corporate underwriters such as Wordsworth make up one-third of WBUR's $20 million annual budget. So when Stavis decided recently that he would no longer contribute to the station to protest what he calls WBUR's and NPR's anti-Israel editorial bias, the decision was viewed only one way.
With regret?
Jane Christo is WBUR's general manager.
I regret the fact that anybody would withdraw their support of the station, particularly now in a downturn economy and when we, as well as other public radio stations and other media outlets, have suffered from lack of underwriting or lack of advertising. However, I think that he has every right to do that if that's the way he feels.
Their work in general is wonderful, and that's why we support them. They do terrific community stuff. On the other hand, there's been an accretion of bias, misrepresentation, and factual error that's been going on for so long that I think at some point I just said, enough is enough.
Stavis says that NPR's use of terms like activists to describe what he says are Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists is an example of journalistic bias. But the breaking point for him was WBUR's airing of a locally produced one-hour documentary last April by veteran correspondent Michael Goldfarb called This Year in Jerusalem. WBUR says the documentary was fair and balanced. Stavis says that it included what he considers false elements of history. For example, the 1967 war, he says, was described as a surprise attack by Israel and its neighbors, while the Yom Kippur War was described simply as the 1973 war, and he says that no mention was made that Arab states attacked Israel. Stavis says that while some might regard this as historical nitpicking, for him, it is a critical differentiation.
To my mind, that would be like National Public Radio reporting December 7th, 1941, with the following report. At 8 o'clock this morning at Pearl Harbor, American forces opened fire on Japanese aircraft.
Hillel Stavis sits on the board of the Boston-based Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, or CAMRA, a pro-Israel watchdog organization that claims 50,000 members nationwide. Andrea Levin, CAMRA's executive director, says the group focuses on all mainstream U.S. news organizations, but has found NPR's coverage to be particularly biased.
Our observation in listening for many years is that the coverage is tilted largely towards reflecting the Arab or Palestinian perspective, to the detriment of the mainstream Israeli perspectives.
Shortly after Hillel Stavis announced his suspension of funding for WBUR, his action was followed by Robert Shulman, the CEO of the Cognex Corporation, a Boston-area technology firm that has donated more than $120,000 to WBUR over the past 5 years. He sent out a letter to about 40 other business executives across the nation, urging them also to protest NPR's alleged anti-Israel bias by withholding funds from local public radio outlets. WNYC in New York, which produces this program, WBEZ in Chicago, and KCRW in Los Angeles have received complaints about NPR's coverage.
Fayez Sheikh had hoped to have his harvest finished by now, but he hasn't even started yet. That's because his trees are inside the security fence of the West Bank Jewish settlement of Oranit. For weeks, Sheikh and his family have come to the gate of the settlement hoping to get in. Every day they were told to wait, and hours later they left disappointed.
This story, which aired on Weekend Edition November 24th, was one of the reports that CAMRA complained about. Andrea Levin of CAMRA.
The reporter, Linda Gradstein, was relating that Palestinians were being prevented from harvesting olives because of Israel's harsh policies. It was introduced by Scott Simon, who says that this has been a contentious issue and that, in fact, settlers had recently this year killed an 18-year-old Palestinian girl who was picking olives with her family. And the rest of the piece then is given over to some Israelis from the far left who condemn Israel.
NPR describes this kind of criticism as, quote, partisan, one element of a decade-long campaign. NPR ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin admits the network could do a better job of reporting the underlying politics of the conflict more fully, but finds little merit to CAMRA's overall objections. And he adds that listeners expressed their confidence in public radio journalism in a recent poll commissioned by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
It shows that of the 1,000 people interviewed, 10% think that the coverage on public radio has been pro-Israel, 8% thinks it's been pro-Palestinian, and just under 60% thinks it's been pretty fair, with the remainder not having an opinion on it. And I think that that's not a bad indication of the mail I've been getting, which seems to try to push on one side or the other, but basically thinks that NPR has been doing a reasonable job on covering the Middle East, a very difficult subject at the best of times.
Groups representing Arab interest also have complained over the years about NPR's coverage. The Palestinian-run Media Monitors Network, for example, says that NPR downplays violence against Palestinians.
To assess whether the issue has been covered fairly, you need to look really at the totality of the coverage over a sustained period of time.
Alan Stavitsky is the author of Independence and Integrity, a Guideline for Public Radio Journalism. He is Associate Dean of the University of Oregon Journalism School.
I think if you apply that test, then I think NPR has done a very fair and balanced job of hearing from all sides of the controversy. But if you focus on an individual story or commentary or documentary, then it might appear that there was not balanced coverage.
And that, in some ways, is the crux of the matter. The individual story versus the sweep of coverage over a long period of time. A difficult issue to navigate, says Stavitsky, given the complexities of the situation and the relatively little airtime available to tell a story. As emotion builds in the aftermath of each suicide bombing, the protests are likely to get louder and the financial impact sharper. NPR Ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin.
Well, the principle has to be the same, whether it's $20 or $20 million. If we think that our journalism is strong, then I think that people will listen and support public broadcasting. But if we can be changed or diminished by a lobby group, I think that would be a real shame and a real loss to American journalism.
WBUR's Jane Christo says there may yet be a silver lining to the controversy over coverage of the Middle East.
If nothing else, it definitely keeps us aware and on our toes. If we are questioned about the stories that we do, then we will have a tendency to question ourselves as to the balance and fairness that we are reporting.
Within the last week, WBUR lost another underwriter. Jewish groups held meetings with NPR and WBUR executives to discuss the situation. They plan to meet again in the coming weeks. According to one participant, the only agreement arrived at so far is the recognition that coverage of the Middle East may always prove difficult for reporters who, like the Israelis and Palestinians themselves, are stuck in interminably contentious territory. For On the Media, I'm Philip Martin in Boston.
When Andrew Meldrum got his posting to Zimbabwe several years ago, he thought he would be writing uplifting stories about the journey of an ex-English protectorate to full independence. But, led by President Robert Mugabe, Zimbabwe has been falling into a deepening crisis. With the economy faltering, Mugabe has been scapegoating anyone and everyone. Now, with the most draconian anti-press bill to date awaiting his signature, it's the journalist's turn to bear the brunt of his anger and accusations. Andrew Meldrum is the Zimbabwe correspondent for The Guardian newspaper and The Economist magazine. He joins us from Harare. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You are now on the official list of journalists accused by the Zimbabwean government of terrorism. So exactly what terrorist acts have you committed?
Well, the reason that they've put me on this list is because I've written about the struggle for the Zimbabwean people for multi-party democracy, also corruption in the economy, and, generally an unaccountable government.
Branding someone a terrorist would seem to invite maybe vigilantism. Are you in any physical danger?
Yes, there is physical danger, particularly as Robert Mugabe has vigilante groups, the war veterans and the Central Intelligence Organization, that have attacked anybody that is identified as an enemy of the government. So it's not a pleasant situation, really.
It's easy for me to sit here and scoff at the preposterousness of the rhetorical inflation behind calling a journalist a terrorist. But how about Zimbabweans? Is anyone there, ordinary Zimbabweans, buying this, or do they see this as Mugabe doing what Mugabe does?
It's very much seen as Mugabe doing what Mugabe does. The state propaganda has become so shrill and so antagonistic and aggressive that people just turn it off and stop listening to it, and they say they just believe the opposite.
The radicalization of Robert Mugabe seems to be tracking, a completely parallel track with the disintegration of Zimbabwe's economy. There's certain echoes of Weimar Germany here and scapegoating, or aren't there?
Yes, there are many. You know, one is the scapegoating and blaming white farmers, blaming the white population in general, blaming gays. You know, there are many different minority groups that Robert Mugabe has tried to blame for his problems. The other thing that's very similar is the way he has twisted and manipulated the rule of law, taking over the courts, illegally firing judges and appointing new ones who are his followers, the use of state-sponsored violence, and then not allowing the police to do anything about it, the misuse of the police to hound legal opposition parties. That, you know, there are many things that are similar to the way the Nazis came into power, in fact.
Zimbabwean journalists have been treated like the enemy for some time now. Do you think that this latest move by the government against foreign press is going to have a chilling effect or the opposite on the journalistic community in Harare?
Well, I think it will. And remember, the acts that he's taking against journalism, in addition to branding a group of us as terrorists, his government has also prepared a bill that they have published and they are about to submit to Parliament, which is to control the press. And press experts say that it's one of the most repressive press laws in the world. And it's not just the foreign press, it's the local press. And for more than a year, brave Zimbabwean journalists who have criticized the government have been beaten, two have been tortured. A huge bomb blast destroyed the printing press of the main independent daily newspaper. You know, so this is part of a widespread campaign that the government is doing because they want to silence the critical press before the presidential elections in March next year.
On these shores, at least, Mugabe has run his increasingly repressive regime without a whole lot of notice, even when, as you mentioned before, he was inciting citizens to violently seize farms and other land of white property owners. Is it possible that this latest act of repression, this branding of journalists as terrorists, will backfire on him and just call more attention in the West to, you know, what has become a de facto dictatorship and to the economic desperation of the country?
It looks like there's going to be a confrontation. It looks like the government is going to try to silence the press. And yes, I think it's going to have a negative effect internationally, but also I think it's going to have a negative effect locally because people are just going to be even that much more mad and determined to vote against Mr. Mugabe.
All right, Andrew Meldrum, thank you very much. And be careful.
Thanks.
Andrew Meldrum is the Zimbabwe correspondent for The Economist magazine and the newspaper The Guardian. He spoke to us from Harare, Zimbabwe. Friday, after multiple meetings with the Bush administration, Hollywood answered the president's call to patriotism and released the three-minute film The Spirit of America, a montage of American movie clips that reflect many aspects of the American character, including diversity.
I like to be in America, okay by me in America.
Just
gonna
let everybody know that I'm Jewish.
Jewish? American.
My skin is black.
The Spirit of America's director, Chuck Workman, is a master of the movie montage. He's created special film sequences for the Academy Awards and won an Oscar for his 1987 short documentary on favorite flicks from the last 50 years. While The Spirit of America has a Capra-esque quality to it, some of its selections, such as The Deer Hunter and Born on the 4th of July, were not exactly the patriotic feel-good hits of their respective summers. Still, Workman says, their spirit is undeniably American.
Born on the 4th of July, even though it was about an anti-war activist, there are scenes that could have been in the most heroic John Wayne movie when this poor guy is shot and paralyzed and becomes a quadriplegic. And that the fact that he becomes an anti-war activist is even more American than if he were not. And that's part of our culture, is to be this kind of defiant person who basically follow our own instincts. So to me, that was as American as, you know, the Green Berets movie itself.
So you didn't cheat. I mean, it's not out of context taking something that was meant ironically and presenting it as earnest?
No, it's not earnest. I think if you don't feel the irony of the film, then you miss the point of the film. The film is surprising people because it has those scenes. It has One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It has Easy Rider. What could be more American than Easy Rider now, when in 68 it was thought of as, you know, some sort of radical hippie movie?
Well, I guess the idea of the reluctant hero is as significant a Hollywood archetype as there is.
And that kind of reflects on America's political situation right now, in that we're kind of the reluctant aggressor or the reluctant revenge taker or whatever you want to call it. You know, like, don't mess with us.
the reluctant revenge taker.
But, you know, you even look at Aaron Brockovich or characters like that, modern characters. Big Daddy, we have a scene from, because we have a section about family. These are people that didn't necessarily, they were going about their own lives, then suddenly something is thrust upon them. And what the American movie does is the American movie says, okay, this character is about to be do something heroic, do something that they're pushed to the edge and they succeed. And as melodramatic as that may sound and as artificial as that may sound, it's very much like life in that these things are thrust upon us. And we're all not heroes, but if we have to be, we can be. And I think that's another thing that came out of September 11th is that there are a lot of heroes that we didn't even think about.
The White House has been proactive in dealing with Hollywood and has some interest in keeping the American public on message with respect to the war on terrorism and the whole post-September 11th mood. And I think there has been some discomfort, including on this program, about some slick government propaganda campaign. Did you have this on your mind as you made The Spirit of America?
Actually, I was trying to ignore it. I didn't want to be involved in the content skewing a certain way. And I think that's why you're noticing these films that are not necessarily the flag-waving films. The President's Committee is encouraging this film, and they're certainly behind it, but it wouldn't have been the film that they would have made.
Chuck Workman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Editor, writer, director Chuck Workman is the auteur behind The Spirit of America, debuting this weekend on 10,000 screens across the country. Coming up, an actor who plays terrorists makes a film about real ones, and the Queen's Christmas speech has become a royal bore.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The terrorist attacks awakened America to its tarnished image in the Arab world. We've heard a lot about our unpopular politics, but not as much about our image in Arab pop culture. Walter Armbrust is a professor of modern Middle Eastern studies at Oxford. He says the image of America inspires equal measures of love and loathing, especially on the big screen.
There's actually an Egyptian film that was made in about 1993 called Land of Dreams, and the Land of Dreams was America, and it was a film about a woman who was about to emigrate to the United States, and the events of the film all revolve around her search for her passport, but of course what it's really about is her rethinking the whole process of emigrating and whether the American dream is really so much better than the place that she comes from, and of course by the end of the film she decides not to go.
Does this ambivalence have its roots, do you suppose, in the population, or is it just the conceit of some screenwriter?
That ambivalence is reflected in the population. You know, most people know about the United States mainly through our own media. So in a way, a certain image of America is a known quantity. But, well, America is rarely portrayed as an unambiguous good thing, and you do indeed find the same ambivalence reflected in conversations with people. Of course, one of the stereotypes is that Americans are licentious, and I remember having a conversation with some people once. I'd known them for months, and I was having dinner with them, I and my wife, and in the middle of the conversation, they sort of asked us, is it true that marriage means nothing to Americans? And of course, they knew that we were happily married, and yet this kind of question still comes up. So there's a constant interplay between stereotype and fantasy.
Apart from imagining us as a nation of libertines, how are American characters portrayed in Egyptian films?
Well, there aren't actually that many films that portray Americans or foreigners. And when they do, they're usually there for a rhetorical purpose, to show foreigners as being somehow strange, perhaps laughable, sometimes threatening, but more often just completely incomprehensible.
So, whereas in the news media, America and American policy often are demonized, that doesn't really show up in the film culture.
It does occasionally, but it's the exception to the rule. One of the most famous exceptions is a film called Zaidi Filgamo in Amerikia, which is an Upper Egyptian in the American University. That was made in about 1998. Of course, it's set in the American University, so a large part of the plot has to do with whether the American University is really going to be willing to allow its students to have freedom of speech, to say whatever they want, particularly about the United States' relationship with Israel.
If an American audience were to watch, let's say, the top three Egyptian films at any given moment, and let's assume a perfect translation, would the American audience have any idea what was flickering on the screen in front of them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, these are commercial films. They're, you know, the plot structures are very similar to American commercial films. They borrow wholesale the stories and the plots from American films. It Happened One Night has been made, you know, five times. Irma LaDuce has been made. Double Indemnity has been made. Gilda, Roman Holiday. I mean, there's tons of American stories that have been adapted into the Egyptian screen. These films are not particularly impenetrable to a foreign audience as long as there's a good translation.
Irma LaDuce and Double Indemnity, no wonder they think we're depraved. Walter Arnbrust, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Walter Arnbrust is a professor of modern Middle East studies at Oxford University and the author of Mass Mediations, New Approaches to Popular Culture in the Middle East and Beyond.
Here in America, Hollywood grinds out images of the Middle East chock full of stereotypes. In fact, Tinseltown may be justly criticized for contributing to these tense, racially profiling times. But what of the men whose faces make it possible? Faces like that of Saeed Bedreya, who makes his living playing movie terrorists, including a Palestinian hijacker in 1996's Executive Decision, an Islamic terrorist in 1993's Mirage, and a Hezbollah gunman in 1999's The Insider.
He says you must not sit so close.
What? I can't conduct an interview from back there.
You must move back your chair.
Well, you tell him that when I conduct an interview, I sit anywhere I damn please.
There is no interview.
Mr. Bedreya, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What are some of the other notable bad guys that you've played?
A lot of soap opera, which I hijack someone or kill someone. It used to be a show called The Santa Barbara. I did Days of Our Life. I did Another World. So this wasn't a nice guy role I had to play, but I'm a craftsman.
Have you been criticized for taking some of these roles?
Yeah, after Executive Decision, people didn't see the movie, but heard I play a terrorist. And in the mosque was confrontation, and it's almost get you know, shuffled people and shouting, and it wasn't good time.
So Somewhere along the line, you said you decided to do the De Niro thing and research these bad guys that you played. How did you do that?
I went to the local mosque, and I found out there are wonderful people, very religious. So I hang around, and I become part of the mosque, and I like it because it was a community for me. And in 1993, the group, Jihad Movement from New York, came to Los Angeles to try to take over the mosque. Dr. Omar Abdulrahman, the blind sheikh, came to the mosque, him and his follower.
He is the man who was convicted of responsibility in the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center.
Correct. He came with his group, and he tried to have a base of his operation in Los Angeles.
What did you learn from watching these people about how to more accurately portray the characters you were given?
You know, they're not a cartoon character like I used to play them before. They are a human being. They happen to have a really bad ideology, but they are a human being and have dream and struggle like all of us.
Now you've undertaken a kind of cinematic response to what you've seen and heard in the next decade, a documentary project. Could you tell us about that?
I was starting researching the making of a terrorist and how they recruit innocent young men. I want to protect all Arab American kids and all Arab American young men who are very isolated today. And I want to bring a scholar as good as Bin Laden in the way of teaching to diffuse his attention of bringing young men to kill themselves.
Mr. Bedreya, after everything you've seen and everything you've heard, in your effort to make a life as an actor, do you feel a conflict about taking the roles of terrorists and gunmen and hijackers that you took before?
If I do pass this role, is that role not going to be played by someone else? A Mexican or an Israeli or Iranian or Pakistani will play this role.
Most recently, you played a pediatrician and not an evil pediatrician in the film Shallow Hal. Does this signal perhaps a change in the direction of your acting career?
It's me. I'm a nice guy. I can be a doctor. I can be, you know, you can bring me to your house. I'm honest. I have to be honest with the character I play. If someone asking me to play someone wearing a woman clothes, I'm going to shave my beard and wear a woman clothes and act like a woman. That's my profession.
But be warned what happened to Richard Chamberlain. You don't want to get trapped in those doctor roles.
No. Believe me or not, there are going to be not too many doctor roles. But I would love to do history stuff. And I want to do the groundwork that have hard time in America. But my son, 10 years from now, I don't want him to change his name from Muhammad to Michael because Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden will not control us. Osama bin Laden will not have our face look like him.
Mr. Bedreya, thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. And I'd like to say Happy New Year to everyone and Happy Ramadan and Assalamu alaikum.
Actor Saeed Bedreya is currently on the big screen playing a pediatrician in the Farrelly Brothers film Shallow Hal.
This week, Afghanistan's interim government, dominated by the Northern Alliance, announced the appointment of PR man Thomas Loria as Chief of Public Affairs. Loria's credentials for the job consist mainly of his work for the Tobacco Institute, the lobbying arm of the tobacco industry in Washington. For decades, that organization claimed cigarettes were non-addictive and that the health consequences of smoking were an unproven scientific controversy. On the Media has obtained,
well, not really,
the first commercial to be aired by Loria's office, aimed at repairing the Northern Alliance's lingering image problems.
Say, Danya, let's go to Kandahar and repress some Pashtuns.
No way, Muhammad.
But it'll be cool. We can marginalize them politically, engage in fierce tribal warfare, pitting our warlords against theirs. We can devolve to petty banditry and even murder and torture the innocent.
Count me out.
I don't need to repress an ethnic minority to be cool.
That's right, Danya. At the Northern Alliance, we believe torture and political repression should be adult decisions. While we see no convincing evidence of human rights violations against power-greedy, inferior tribes, we recognize that it is an ongoing controversy filled with emotion on both sides.
Maybe you're right, Danya. Let's play hopscotch. There'll be plenty of time to murderously consolidate power when we're 15.
This message brought to you by the Northern Alliance, where we say, just say no to ethnic violence for the time being.
Almost every year since 1932, the reigning British monarch has addressed the nation on Christmas afternoon. It started with King George V, the present Queen's father, whose Christmas message went out on the radio. These days, Queen Elizabeth II's Christmas message is broadcast simultaneously on British television and radio and on many other networks around the world. Last year, viewing figures fell below 10 million for the first time ever, down from a record high of 17 million back in 1987. Can a tradition from the days of empire possibly have any cultural resonance today? Gareth Mitchell filed this report from London.
By any measure, this millennium year has been an unforgettable one. Since the turn of the year...
The Queen's opening paragraph from last year's Christmas broadcast. As is the custom, the monarch referred back to the year just gone and then went on to reflect on the Christian significance of Christmas.
Christmas is the traditional, if not the actual birthday, of a man who was destined to change the course of our history. And today, we are celebrating the fact that Jesus Christ...
For Matt Wells, media correspondent at The Guardian, the annual broadcast serves at least one obvious purpose.
The Queen doesn't have much contact with her subjects during the year, apart from the occasional walkabout and appearances on television. She certainly doesn't speak to them very much. So it's the one opportunity for people in Britain who have little contact with the monarchy actually to hear the sound of their voice. And I think it's this slightly odd nature of the broadcast that makes it such a strong tradition.
That strong tradition goes back to the broadcast's early days, when it was an opportunity for the monarch to talk to the British Empire. Though most of the empire has gone now, the Queen's former spokesman, Dickie Arbiter, says the sentiments of the address, largely based on values and spirituality, remain much the same.
At the end of the day, this is a Christmas message to the Commonwealth, and there is the religious aspect to it without ramming home the idea of Christianity. It's also a sort of look back on the year, of some of the highlights of the year, and with television they try to bring in the pictures of some of these highlights.
Filming footage from royal tours to include in the Christmas message is a fairly recent innovation. Until about 5 years ago, the Queen simply addressed the camera. In recent transmissions, the Queen has treated viewers to glimpses of Windsor Castle, and she's tried all kinds of TV techniques usually reserved for the slick media professionals, a royal effort to craft must-see TV, and to be sure that it is...
The Queen's Christmas broadcast is shown at 3 o'clock on the two major television networks in Britain. They take it in turns to produce it and show it at the same time.
Guardian media correspondent Matt Wells.
So it's one of those very few leftovers of patrician Britain where the broadcasters almost tell you that actually now you have to sit down and watch this.
And for those viewers who consider the Queen's message the television equivalent of watching paint dry, there is an option.
Channel 4, one of the more subversive British broadcasters, doesn't broadcast the Queen's Christmas message. Instead, it broadcasts an alternative Christmas message, as it describes it. It invites controversial or interesting figures from the year to come and give their take on Christmas.
This year, it's thought that a survivor from the World Trade Center attacks is going to give the alternative message. The contents of the Queen's broadcast are always a closely guarded secret. By sweet-talking Buckingham Palace, I was hoping to bring a scoop to On the Media, but sadly, to no avail. Uniquely, the Queen's words in the Christmas message are her own. Just about everything else she utters in public is prepared by the government. The personal tone and its strict embargo is always a welcome Christmas gift to journalists manning the country's otherwise quiet newsrooms. Matt Wells.
For the British newspapers and the British news broadcasters, the Queen's Christmas message gives them a bit of a handle on Christmas Day. And indeed, in recent years, the Queen's Christmas broadcast has made the top of the headlines. So it is still very much a talking point.
But who's going to be tuning in this year? Well, I thought the Kensington area of London, close to the former home of the late Princess of Wales, would be a good place to canvass some opinion from the streets as to whether the broadcast is a must-see Christmas Day event. Will you be watching the broadcast this year?
Absolutely, yes.
Why is that?
It's the thing you do every year, so gonna see the old girl on TV. Absolutely, it has to be done.
I think it's on at the wrong time during the day.
Right, so it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's not convenient for you.
It's not, no.
I normally do tend to watch it, but don't really pay that much attention. It's just a traditional thing of just moving wallpaper, I think.
Do you think it's a good thing that it still happens, though?
It's part of tradition, and she is still the monarch of the country, after all.
Well, the nation might be shrugging its shoulders now, but next Tuesday's telly event will be watched, as usual, by millions. But that's just us British view. I mean, it's not as if we celebrate the fact that the Queen's head is on our currency, but talk of replacing it with the euro, and we suddenly come over all patriotic. So, whilst it's true that there might be a collective glazing over of the eyes across Britain at 3 p.m. on December the 25th, to even think of a Yuletide without the Queen's speech, well, it's just not cricket, is it? For On the Media, this is Gareth Mitchell in London.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, with Sean Landis and Michael Cavanaugh, engineered by George Edwards and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Allison Lichter, John Keefe, Liam Ben-Zvi, and Sophie Kaplan. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
A man who was destined to change the course of our history.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.